Old Jonathan Howlett was obviously softening in his old age. He couldn't believe he had actually given in to this crazy idea. For the past 3 summers, a few of the local boys had been pestering him to allow them to investigate the local museum. Jonathan had come into possession of the Old West Living Museum, a modest but well-loved collection of historic buildings that had been relocated to the outskirts of town by his father back in the 1960s. Somehow, the museum had garnered a reputation for spooky happenings. And old Jonathan Howlett had garnered his own reputation for being a crotchety, dismissive, and surly old man. There was nothing scary, spooky, or haunted about the old buildings, but the stories from the guests were never ending. There was a young banker seen counting gold in the bank, a shopkeeper stocking shelves in the apothecary, a child was heard reciting poetry in the schoolhouse, and there was a particularly awful tale of a faceless woman screaming in the hotel. All nonsense, all fiction, and all very irritating to Jonathan. Yet somehow, he had been bamboozled into allowing the Cooper and Henderson boys to investigate the property. They had been so persistent, so excited, and had spent all their paper round money on a season pass to the museum. Jonathan didn't even sell season passes, but he respected their patronage and cut them a deal. They had pored over microfiche at the library to find out more about the buildings, who owned them, and who frequented them. They had even taught Jonathan a few things. So, after the 1,000th time of pleading for an overnight investigation, Jonathan caved. Sure, the buildings were delicate and historic, but they had survived this long. What could 3 measly teenage boys with camcorders really do to them? Besides, there were worse things the boys could be doing on a Friday night. The boys arrived around nightfall. They threw their bikes unceremoniously under the oak tree and unloaded backpacks full of flashlights, recording devices, camcorders, and gizmos and gadgets Jonathan was sure had been lifted from their dad's toolboxes. The Cooper boys were twins, with auburn hair and noses covered in a spray of amber freckles. Michael Henderson was the real brains of the outfit. He coordinated the plan for the night and extended an invite to Jonathan. At first, he scoffed. "There ain't nothing up in them old buildings." "How do you know?" Mike asked. "You've never investigated with us." Mike's mahogany eyes and goofy grin made Jonathan chuckle and think of a simpler time. He hated to admit it, but it was nice to see 3 best friends excited to enjoy a wholesome night of fun. "Y'all are going to be real disappointed about sunrise," Jonathan said as he picked up a flashlight and followed the trio to the dusty old bank. For hours, they sat in the dark, dry counting house. Then they spent another equally quiet hour in the saloon, the school, the doctor's office, followed up by a flashlight experiment in the old town square. There was no activity. No flickering lights, no sounds of footsteps or voices. Just 3 enthusiastic baby ghost hunters and an intrigued old man exploring the town. Jonathan was amazed. The boys never tired, never became impatient. They were thrilled and thankful for the opportunity to spend the night sitting silently in the basement of these decrepit, crumbling buildings. Their joy was genuine, pure, and made Jonathan a little sad. They were not going to catch any ghosts tonight. Jonathan excused himself and grumbled about getting a cold drink and meeting up with them in the hotel. As Jonathan left, he scampered quietly to the hotel. He couldn't give them a ghost, but he could give them a fright. He tore up the stairs and lumbered into the room the faceless woman was reported in. In the black of the room, he felt his way towards the closet. It took some convincing to muscle the door open. The wood had obviously swelled in the summer's heat. But once he had prized it ajar, he clambered inside and waited for the boys. A few minutes later, he could hear Mike telling the Cooper twins about the reported faceless lady as they ascended the stairs.
"They say her husband went crazy after he found out she was having an affair. They argued, and she pleaded for him to calm down. But he was so enraged that he took out his shotgun and held it to her forehead."
"Is that why she's always reported as faceless?"
one of the twins asked.
"I guess. But you want to know the worst part? She didn't die. Well, not immediately. After her husband pulled the trigger and blew her face to smithereens, she turned around and caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror. That's why she's always seen screaming."
"How could she scream if he blew her face off? How could she even see?"
"I don't know. I wasn't there. But that's the story."
This was not the story. Jonathan did know of a woman who had died in the hotel, but of tuberculosis, and on the first floor. She had a full face and rotten lungs, so screaming was out of the question. But he, too, had heard this retelling many, many times. As the boys approached the room, Jonathan could hear their footsteps become more tentative and reluctant.
Maybe we should wait for Mr. Howlett,"
one of the twins said.
"Yeah, it's unfair to go without him,"
retorted the other.
"Unfair? It's his old building. He can come whenever he likes. And besides, you know what he'd say. You head on in there. There ain't nothing but spiders and termites haunting this town."
Jonathan smiled. "Attaboy," he thought to himself. Three pairs of ambling footsteps continued towards the room. As the boys slowly entered the space, Jonathan swung open the closet door with a flourish and a growl. All three boys went sheet white, screamed, and fell over each other trying to frantically escape the room. From the tangled heap of gangly teenage limbs on the floor came a chorus of laughter as the boys came to realization. However, Jonathan was silent, back turned to the trio.
"Mr. Howlett?"
one of the twins asked as he helped up his friends.
"You okay?"
Jonathan was rigid, bolt upright, arms stoic at his side.
"Hey, Mr. Howlett. Mr. Howlett."
"Boys, you need to run."
What do you mean?"
"Boys, you need to run now."
As the boys followed Jonathan's piercing stare, the trio looked towards the corner of the room. There, in a blood-soaked frock, stood a woman with a face of pouring pockmarks. Blood and brain matter covering where her forehead once was. One eye was a lidless fountain of streaming gore. The other was fixed on the group. In one slow, horrifying motion, shriveled lips parted, revealing a tongueless gape sheltered by broken teeth. And from the bloody pit came a spluttering, wrenching scream.
Hey friends, it's Becca.
For the past 3 years, the West London Witch team have been dedicated to bringing you the best supernatural stories at the highest studio quality. And by team, I mean me and my buddy Danny. We do this work totally for free because we love it. We're proud of our content and appreciate the wonderful interactions we get to have with storytellers and listeners just like yourself. If you're enjoying the West London Witch, maybe consider joining our Patreon. It's a way to further engage with us and show your support for Two Creatives. If you're in a position to spare enough each month for us to grab a cup of coffee in between edits or add to the piggy bank for a new microphone, we would love to see you in our Patreon community. But I know times are tough, so if you're not in a position to join Patreon right now, that's okay. We aren't going anywhere. Head on over to patreon.com/The West London Witch. For as little as £1, $1, €1 a month, you can gain full access to our coven, a space where we share behind-the-scenes stories, dive deeper into each episode, answer your questions, and have special little treats to thank you for sharing your love and kindness with your favorite little witch. Hello and welcome to the season 4 premiere of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. I have missed you all over the summer break, but I am elated to begin this new season together and dive into the fourth anthology that is The West London Witch. Today, we are beginning the season with a bang. Brandon Alvis began his journey into the paranormal by investigating local humble hauntings and has now grown into one of the stars of A&E's Ghost Hunters, host and director of Haunted Discoveries TV, and the author of Elements of a Haunting. He is a historian, a researcher, and a man dedicated to conducting his paranormal research in a measurable scientific fashion. He also, coincidentally, is from my hometown. Unbeknown to either of us, Brandon and I actually grew up around the corner from each other. So it's very special to me to begin this season with not only an internationally renowned ghost hunter, but also a Bakersfield boy. I hope you're all sitting comfortably, for we are about to embark on a journey through a collection of spine-chilling tales and haunting EVPs. I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, Episode 56, Humble Haunts.
It was 2006, and I was working at the Buck Owens Crystal Palace in Bakersfield, California, and I always had an interest in the paranormal, but never really actively went out looking for it. It was all just kind of book research and in the early days of online, looking at videos and looking at different things associated with ghosts and hauntings from a psychic perspective or all the way to scientific type of investigation. And one of the guys I worked with at Crystal Palace claimed that his uncle owned this abandoned farmhouse out on the west side of town. And they claimed that there was a suicide murder that took place on the property and that the uncle would no longer utilize the property because of all the paranormal activity taking place within the farmhouse. So they would actually farm around the property, but the house itself laid in an arrested decay and in a really bad state for a number of years. I don't think anyone lived there since the 1960s.
Brandon's curiosity was immediately piqued. Unfortunately, he was no stranger to death, loss, and wondering about the other side. In 1995, Brandon tragically lost a brother to cancer. Then in 2004, more sadness befell his family when another brother died from suicide. Brandon was curious to see if he could find some evidence associated with the consciousness surviving death.
So I took this opportunity to go out to this abandoned farmhouse on the outskirts of Bakersfield, California, in the farmlands. And at the time, I was playing music and a musician working at the Crystal Palace as a stagehand and running monitors for the band. So I took the only equipment I had that I think would help aid the investigation. And that was various audio recording devices. And I went out there and started to just light the place up with condenser microphones and a DAW recording software and tube preamps and all this kind of crazy stuff you would typically use within recording a band in a studio. So I set all this stuff up. I run all the cabling out to a PT Cruiser I had at the time, and I kind of set up shop in the back of the car, opened the hatch, had the computer sitting there, all of the mics running out to the recording software, and I just kind of sat there in the middle of this farmland listening very intently, trying to see if I could hear anything. And then a couple hours into it, I started to hear extremely heavy footsteps that started to pace across the entirety of this living room floor of this abandoned farmhouse. And as I'm listening, the footsteps are getting louder as it gets closer to the microphone. And then all of a sudden, I hear this very deep, guttural voice of a man say, "There's nobody here." I mean, it was so loud and so clear, I threw the headphones off of my ears. I was so frightened by what I heard.
Brandon's immediate reaction was to run into the home and investigate. Was someone in there? A vandal, perhaps? A homeless person seeking refuge? Kids messing about?
I run in with my bandmate, who was also there helping me record at the time. And we run in, and there was absolutely nobody in the building. And to this day, it's a piece of audio that not only baffles my mind, but is also a piece of audio I've taken to various audio engineers that have put it through spectrum analysis that have no explanation as to what it is. It's not a stray radio frequency. It's not a stray or cell phone frequency. It doesn't have the vocal range of a person, but it sounds like a person. It very much sounds like a living, breathing human within that room, but it doesn't line up with what the frequencies of a human vocal pattern should be within spectrum analysis.
Have a listen to this EVP and see what you think. I can clearly hear heavy footfall, labored breathing, and then a deep, low voice say, "There's no one here."
A couple of weeks later, I came back to the farmhouse. At this point, I wanted to try and record visually anything happening in the building. So I got my hands on this old school Hi-8 recording camera from Sony that was probably from the late 1990s. Had night vision on it, went into the house and just started scanning the entire living room around the same area where we captured this amazing voice along with what sounded like footsteps. And I go home, nothing really happened in the moment, but I put this tape into the VCR and I start to look at it. And all of a sudden there's a woman, perfectly transparent, standing in the corner, kind of shielded. It looked terrified. It looked like almost like someone that was being accosted or yelled at, something like that. And I still to this day have no explanation as to what it is. So at this point, within my early days of investigating, not only do I have this amazing piece of audio and this EVP, but I have this visual anomaly that's taken place in the same room that seems to very much correlate with this story about this murder-suicide of this man and woman that took place there in the 1940s.
The next day, invigorated by this new evidence, Brandon headed to the Kern County Library to do as much research as possible on the property and the former inhabitants. He pulled the original land deeds, planning permission, Sanborn fire insurance maps, and any birth or death certificates registered to the address.
And I could never find anything associated with a murder-suicide that took place within this building. And it was really the first time I started to think about thought form manifestation and what is belief and how does that, you know, how is that a part of the mechanics of what we perceive to be ghosts and hauntings? And it kind of started to play itself out in a way where over a span of years and decades that people are telling this continuous story about this murder-suicide that by all accounts didn't factually happen. But, you know, kids from the neighborhoods, people coming out to this place, you know, projecting this story in their mind into this environment seems to have played itself out in a way. And that kind of, you know, launched my journey into the paranormal and launched my interest even further after the death of my brothers, that there's something out there going on that we can't explain. And it looks like we very much can document that in some way.
Years later, Brandon returned to the farmhouse. And this time, he brought a psychic.
She said that there was a photo hidden within the house, right? There was a photo hidden somewhere in the home. At that point, it didn't make any sense to me because it's an abandoned property. And there's nothing anywhere. I mean, there's holes in the floor. I don't see how anything could be hidden. And then one of the investigators I was with us said, you know, let's look behind the mirror. I think that there's an old custom that people from the late 1800s all the way up to the 40s would hide photos behind mirrors. And we took the mirror off and there was a photo of a man and a woman in that mirror behind this cabinet. Again, who those people were, I'm not sure. But historically, there was never any documentation to support this murder-suicide, but there's definitely something spooky happening at that location. And unfortunately, about 10 years ago, they tore down the property. But that was my start into all of it. And one of the scariest experiences I've ever had, because not only having, I guess, a personal experience, but through the document, you know, the documentation process and actually having that experience documented, not only visually, but audibly, was something to this day that sticks with me and is something that I'll never forget.
This was Brandon's first tangle with the paranormal, but it springboarded him into a lifelong search for more answers, more evidence, and more unexplainable phenomenon. His next story takes us back to one of our former haunts, the RMS Queen Mary.
So it was a 2008, I think it was December 2008, I was lucky enough to go into the RMS Queen Mary and have access to the first class pool, which is, you know, anyone that knows the RMS Queen Mary knows the legend that is the RMS Queen Mary, and specifically the first class pool, and specifically the first class pool changing stalls. Peter James, the famous psychic from the show Sightings many years ago, always talked about a little girl named Jackie being in that area. Interesting story. There was never any documentation to support a young girl named Jackie drowning in what was the first class pool at that time. But, you know, seeing those clips of Peter James calling out to this little girl and audibly having responses, I wanted to go down there and check it out myself. So this is the old days of the RMS Queen Mary, where parts of the ship were a little more accessible than they are today, where you can get down to the first class pool, the engine room, things like that. So I got down there with myself, an investigator from APRA in training, and a security guard. And I had a mini DV infrared camera that I wanted to document the entire process with. And we go down to the first class pool changing stalls, and I start to show this investigator in training how to perform an EMF sweep to look for natural electromagnetic radiation and electromagnetic frequencies. So I'm showing her how to conduct the sweep, and the whole time she's holding this mini DV camera in her right hand as she's doing a sweep with her left hand. And at the time, nothing really seemed out of the ordinary. It's an old damp ship. It has it almost feels like there's something there, but that's just the high humidity and being lower in the lower levels of the ship, you start to feel kind of claustrophobic. So it's just kind of a natural response to that, being in that part of the ship. But it wasn't until 9 months later that we reviewed that mini DB tape and we actually captured what is probably the most significant piece of apparition footage I've ever seen to date. And it's something I went to multiple professionals from various technical industries that to this day have no explanation for what it is.
The video is captivating. It's of course filmed in night vision mode, so the entire clip is bathed in a soft green and gray light.
So with the footage, you see on the right-hand corner, in this right-hand changing stall in particular, the movement of the camera is moving up and down because the investigator is performing an EMF sweep. So, but as this movement happens, you see what looks like a little girl almost drop out of the ceiling, slide down the wall, stop about torso height up, peer out that changing stall right down the barrel of the camera, and then all of a sudden it disappears as quick as it shows up. And in the footage, you can see it, one of the clips is slowed down to show it in a slower pattern, about 200% slower. And you can see how this figure manifests out of absolutely nowhere and actually manifests halfway through the floor, which is really interesting. But it's a clip that I'll never forget and something that I think will blow a lot of people's minds.
Make sure you head on over to the West London Witch Instagram and Facebook to see this incredible footage for yourself. Brandon has had this video extensively analyzed by multiple doctors, videographers, scientists, and has shared it at many conventions and lectures that he has conducted.
I had a doctor who specifically was an eye doctor come up to me and talk about the way that the footage and specifically the eyes of this apparition are reacting to the infrared light. You know, obviously our eyes react to infrared with the pupil and the cornea, and that's going to show up. And when we're in the dark, our pupils dilate, right? They get larger. But this specific piece of footage and this specific figure, whatever it may be, the pupils are 100% dilating. And this doctor, this eye doctor, told me that he can tell me without a shadow of a doubt it's not a living person because of that specific fact.
Exactly 1 year later, Brandon went back to the RMS Queen Mary in an attempt to replicate the video.
But this time, I stood at the old slide that's there at the foot of the changing stalls and right there in front of the pool. And I started calling out to who people believe is Jackie. About 20 minutes into that, I started to have a little girl's voice call back out and something that we documented on audio. And what made that even spookier, what's something that kind of still chills me to this day, is the fact that that voice seemed to radiate out of the exact area where we captured that apparition 1 year prior.
Our final cluster of stories takes us to a place in Santa Clarita, a city just north of LA and about 90 miles south of Bakersfield.
So it was about 2010, I was investigating a place called Heritage Junction Park in Santa Clarita, California, which is a really amazing collection of 9 historical buildings that have been moved from all over the county to what is now known as William S. Hart Park in Santa Clarita. And it's called Heritage Junction Park. It's ran by the Santa Clarita Valley Historical Society. And I was very lucky at the time because I was doing a lot of fundraising events with the Historical Society where we would do public ghost hunts where we'd bring people in. They would pay for a ticket and all proceeds would benefit the historical restoration of those 9 historical buildings. And one building on that property in particular was a place called the Saugus Train Station. So it was a train station that was actually used in a Charlie Chaplin film many years ago and was moved to what is now Heritage Junction Park. But there was a lot of ghost stories associated with it. And no one could ever really pinpoint exactly what those ghost stories were beyond just sounds and feelings and things like that. Never really any historical context, to who it may be. And one night, myself and another investigator were in the Saugus train station. And because I was lucky enough to investigate these locations, they gave me full access. It was almost like a paranormal boot camp for me, where they would just give me the keys and say, hey, go have fun. So we had a completely contained environment, and the contamination was very low. We were up in the living quarters to the Saugus train station when an Amtrak train started to pass. This was around 2 a.m. And funny enough, they located this one-time train station right next to an active Amtrak train track that would go right next to the building.
When the Amtrak train passed by the building, it was deafeningly loud. You couldn't speak over the sound of the wheels on the track, the bells, the whistles, and the train horns.
And as the train starts to pass, on audio, we capture a very clear, probably the most clear Class A EVP we've ever collected of a British woman saying, "Will that be on the train?" To me, at that point, I'm like, one, I mean, obviously there's some kind of consciousness associated with this supposed entity or whatever it may be, that it's acknowledging a train passing, one. But two, why would there be a woman with a British accent in what was virtually an Old West train station? I took this clip and I showed it to the president of the Historical Society at the time, and her jaw hit the floor because there is a piece of historical context and information that she never provided to us and something we didn't know. It's that J.H. Tolfrey, a man who used the train station as an eatery and a hotel, the upper living quarters of the hotel, and then down in the cargo and luggage room, he used it as a restaurant for passengers that would come through. Him and his wife utilized that train station as the hotel and the eatery, but she never told us that J.H. Tolfrey and his wife were from England. And so is this voice of this British woman J.H. Tolfrey's wife? Can't say, but it's definitely an interesting thing to know that we captured a very conscious voice talking about a train passing and does have a very distinct accent from someone that historically did live in that building.
Another property at Heritage Junction Park that Brandon investigated was an old home that used to sit on the site of one of California's most recognizable theme parks.
There was one house on that property called the Newhall Ranch House that anyone from California or has been through California would know, Six Flags Magic Mountain. This Newhall Ranch House used to sit in the parking lot next to what is was once the roller coaster Goliath, an old wooden roller coaster. But that was originally Newhall's property, and Henry Mayo Newhall was his name, and that was his ranch house that he utilized. And funny enough, the stories about this place being haunted go back years and years, because when it was on the property of Six Flags Magic Mountain, the cast members would utilize it to go change and get into their work clothes and utilize it just for a worker space to get away from the park for a little bit. And they all had stories about this place being haunted. And during one of the public tours that we had, we were up on the second floor conducting an EVP session. And we had three or four different audio recorders going at the time. And we started to ask about if there was anyone there that supposedly is haunting location, can you let us know? And, you know, we got this very scary sounding voice of a man moaning in pain. I mean, just so incredibly spooky sounding. I've never heard anything like it. It almost sounds like it's from one of those Halloween tapes that you would get at Party City back in the 90s. You know what I mean? And what's even crazier about that is the fact that Henry Mayo Newhall died because he was actually bucked off of a horse and broke his ribs. And this recording sounds very similar to it. I mean, it's very similar to what I would imagine it would sound like of someone that had broke their ribs and was like, you know, struggling to breathe or call out.
Can you tell us what year it is? What?
I would frequent this location over a number of years, and it was about a couple of years later, after an investigation at the Newhall Ranch House at the Heritage Junction Park, I went back home to Bakersfield, California, where I was living at the time, and went into my apartment, brought in all my gear, set the gear down, and I look up, and the closet door in my living room apartment just starts to open by itself. No one was in the home. The door was shut. It was locked. It just pops open and starts to open itself. So being I had my equipment right there, I grabbed my audio recorder, hit record, set it on my staircase, and I walked up the stairs. Came back about 5 minutes later, played the clip, and I captured the exact same moaning that I did from the Newhall Ranch House that very well could be Henry Mayo Newhall, who seemed to have hitched a ride 95 miles away to Bakersfield, California.
Brandon is a born and bred Bakersfield boy turned paranormal investigator on one of the world's biggest TV shows, A&E's Ghost Hunters. His days are filled with research, film projects, and his own television program, Haunted Discoveries. But the stories that still excite Brandon the most are these ones, stories from his early days. Those first spectacular and precious EVPs, pictures, and videos. His work continues, his projects multiply, but the goal stays the same. What can we discover, experience, and potentially prove in the world of the paranormal? If you'd like to dive into more of Brandon's work, check out his website, brandonjalvis.com, and head on over to the West London Witch Patreon for some additional stories and conversations between myself and Brandon. Do you have a spooky story you'd like to share? I'd love to hear it. Drop me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at The West London Witch. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And come and follow us for additional content on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Mishnade Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them with us.